Give it up for the Freedom Archives. So without further ado, I want to welcome and invite Nathaniel, the co-director of the Freedom Archives, to introduce our guest today.
How's everyone doing today? Cool, thanks. I'm really happy to be in a room with so many people that I know and have great love and respect for, and I'm really, in that sense, enthusiastic that this is the opportunity to have such a wonderful kind of intimate conversation. I want to do a couple just real quick housekeeping Freedom Archives stuff and then introduce our panelists. So firstly, I just want to, the same way that Jesse shouted out Freedom Archives, I want to shout out La Pena. They do really great work. And it's really great to be a part of what is the continued work of highlighting and amplifying anti-imperialist work in the Bay. I also want to thank all the folks who helped make this event possible, not least of all the folks that are about to speak on stage today, but also all the volunteers that helped out. And thank you all for coming. I'm Nathaniel. I'm co-director at Freedom Archives, and I think while, because my parents made it really, they put a great importance on learning Black history, I actually knew about Robert and Mabel Williams before I got to the Freedom Archives in terms of who they were, so that's great. Being at the Freedom Archives and then being able to meet Lisa Inocchinelli and actually be a part of this over 20-year project to preserve and lift up the legacy of this family has been really like a major honor and highlight of my time at Freedom Archives. One of the things that was very, very cool when Claude and I first went to, and they had been doing this work before I started working here. The first, I think, material that came out was in 2005, and I showed up in 2011. But in like 2015 or 16, Claude and I went to Detroit and I was able to meet Lisa and really start being a part of this project. And one of the things that's really important is I was just struck by not just the like importance of the academic or intellectualism of the work around this, which I kind of understood previously because I had read about it or heard about it, but how much actual, like, this was a labor of love in terms of preserving the history. And so that really struck me that in terms of stewarding the ideas and the life and experiences and work of our freedom fighters, that it's not just like an academic enterprise, it is a labor of love. And I think all three people on this stage represent that. So that was a really great learning moment, and I'm so happy to be in further community and comradeship with these folks and continue to learn as this book project takes off and hopefully the work continues. So without ado, I just want to give some brief introductions. This co-director of Freedom Archives, Claude Marks, also one of the founders, been doing this work for a really long time. To the left of Claude is Lisa Williams. Lisa is the daughter-in-law of Robert and Mabel Williams and has really been one of the major stewards in the family in terms of preserving their legacy and making accessible the family history. And to the left of Lisa, Professor Akinyele Omoja, who is at Georgia State University. He's one of the editors of the memoirs of Robert and Mabel Williams, which is the book tour that we're experiencing right now. The book's on the table. He's also heavy in the activist organizing world and has been for, I'm sure, most of his life with organizations like NAPO as well as MXGM. So let's welcome him as well. And without further ado, I'm going to throw it to the panel. Thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. It's a hard choice to make. I know there's a Palestine demonstration happening in Oakland. We would be there if we weren't doing this. So it's a pretty crucial period in the developments, and even though we don't know where it's going to go, we certainly trust and have faith in the resistance in Palestine and continue our unquestioning support of the struggle of the Palestinian people and their anti-colonial aspirations. It's also been a complicated week in as much as we feel the loss of Asada Shakur, who, like the Williams family, had a specific relationship to the Cuban Revolution, in which they've all sought refuge there and got support by the Cuban government, not just coincidentally, but because of the Cuba's role in supporting black liberation. And so with all of the feelings that we have, we certainly want to say that we continue to be inspired by both the Williams family and people like Asada Shakur as well. So, ashe. It's also, you know, in thinking about all of the work that the Freedom Archives has done, in a lot of ways, the documentary that we created, the audio documentary that we created with the voices almost exclusively of Mabel and Robert Williams, is clearly one of the major high points and honors that we have as an organization, and certainly for me personally, in being able to, you know, uplift some of the subjugated history that they represent. And as we get to know them through their memoirs, you'll understand, if you don't already, why their story is subjugated. I mean, that's not a coincidence, and it's part of the intent, obviously, of the imperial beast to, you know, criminalize the aspirations of the Black Liberation Movement. So that, too, is an honor to be part of a process of challenging that. I thought maybe a way to start would be to listen very briefly to a little audio and bring Mabel's voice into the space, and then we'll do that periodically, but it seems appropriate to start there, and then on the basis of that, I'll be trying to draw out a conversation among us. Does that make sense? So, Jesse, if you wouldn't mind.
I was born into a segregated society, but at that time I accepted a segregated society because that's all I knew. But after I got married and we started trying to make a living as a family, I found out that we just kept running into barriers of segregation, and we just could not make the kind of living that other young people, white people, were making. And every time we'd start to try to rise up, somebody was always trying to put us back down in our place.
What is the position of the U.S. government in Dixie, USA? Yes, the same U.S. government that has appointed itself to safeguard the universal rights of man and to make the world safe for democracy. What is its position on defending the rights of black people within the confines of its own borders?
I didn't realize in the very beginning that what was happening to us was wrong, because I didn't know all of the implications of segregation. I knew there was a danger, because my stepfather had a pearl-handled pistol that he kept under his pillow, and it was my job to make up his bed every morning. So I would go and get the pearl-handled pistol and put it in the linen closet every morning. I found out in hearing the older people talk, they told me to handle it, but don't ever shoot it or, you know, put my fingers on the trigger. But I found out hearing the older people talk that that gun was there because there was a threat to our lives.
So given that as an introduction, maybe we should start by saying a little something about how we connect to this history and this process and this family. Maybe we'll start with you, Lisa.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for having me here. I married John in 1998. I met his family in 94. And Rob passed in 1996, so we knew each other for 2.5 years before his passing. When I met them, I didn't know John's story. I didn't know who they were. And basically, they told me who they were. I went home, and I told my father who John's family was. And my brother overheard the conversation, and he came in the room, and the two of them sat me down and took me to school. My father was well aware of Robert and Mabel Williams, and so much so that when they came, John brought them to my dad's house to meet them, and my father, who was rather reserved, conservative kind of man, was as giddy as a child at Christmas. He kept saying, "Robert Williams, a living legend," and he was just going on and on like that, you know, and I thought my dad was gonna genuflect. I'd never seen him like that before. But he was so honored that that man would grace his doorway and have an opportunity to meet him face to face. My dad was a race man, born in 1924. So those conversations, those issues were dining room conversation for us. I was well aware of the race problem in America as a kid. We didn't run from it. So, like I said, John and I, we got married in 98. By that time, Rob was gone. And so it was just Mom as well as, you know, my family and our, you know, brother-in-law. That family was loving and kind and generous to me. But there was a thing about them was different than any other family I've ever known before. They were preppers before preppers ever got on YouTube. And they were very tight in a way of military security, I guess you could say. So they didn't, you know, one time John and I were joking around. I'm from Detroit, and I was playing with him about a dozens game, you know, and he didn't find it funny. You see, when your very life depends on unity, you don't have time for those kind of games. And I noticed that Mom and Rob were really one flesh. There was no daylight between them, even until the end. So I have fond memories, and of course I lost John in 2016 to ALS. Mom got sick with breast cancer and a couple of years before, and we did hospice at home. And 6 months after she passed, we got the diagnosis for John. So it felt like a cruel joke had been played on us, you know. But one of the things John told me before he passed, he said, you know, we got all these people coming over here doing interviews and this and that. He said, but the truth of the matter is you have your own book to write. And so at some point, that's what I will do.
That's going to be a powerful book. And, you know, I can say that in knowing Lisa now for about 6 or 7 years.
7 years.
Wow, this is a lot of time. Time has flown. Wow, but in name of our mothers, fathers, all of our ancestors, I'd like to greet everyone. As Nathaniel mentioned, I'm a member of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. We always greet folks with free the land, free the land, free the land by any means necessary. It's good to be here with so many old friends, old comrades. I want to also acknowledge Liz Darius, who was on, you know, I was thinking earlier she was on COINTELPRO 101. No, she's on the Robert and Mabel Williams. Mm-hmm. Your voice isn't on there?
No, it's
COINTELPRO. Okay, I did have a right. Well, you know, you got to excuse his memory. I'm not getting younger, Liz. All right. But, man, how did I meet, or how did, what's my connection to the Williams family? I only heard Robert Williams speak one time. I only met him one time. I was introduced to Robert Williams through just being introduced to the Black Power movement. And so most of the people who were my heroes, whether it was folks in the Black Panther Party, whether it was Muhammad Ahmed, also known as Max Stanford, whether it was Stokely or H. Rap Brown, Kwesi Balogun, they all mentioned Robert Williams. So, you know, that's how I got introduced to him, because when you're growing up in school, of course, they're not going to tell you who Robert Williams was, right? That's not the type of history they want you to learn. So it was through the movement I was introduced to him. And I think it was in 1977, I was visiting Atlanta. I grew up in Los Angeles and joined the movement there. And I was with Muhammad Ahmed, also known as Max Stanford. And he asked me if I wanted to go hear Robert Williams speak. And he was speaking at a U.S.-China Friendship Association meeting at that particular time. I was also blessed, for those of y'all know the name, Harry Haywood was there to hear Robert Williams. So I met him in the audience during that time, as well as Gwendolyn Hall, his wife at that time, Harry Haywood's wife. And so after Robert passed in 1996 and 97, there at University of New Orleans, they had a lectureship named after Gwendolyn Hall's father. She made sure I was invited there. And the lectureship that year was dedicated to Robert Williams, who was speaking there, but Mabel Williams. And Mabel, along with John, were at that particular symposium. I got a chance to ask Mabel questions. We met her afterwards. And then shortly thereafter, we would invite her to Georgia State, where I was teaching at the time. And after that point, every now and then I would hear from Mabel when she came through Atlanta. Gwendolyn Hall also mentioned to her later on, knowing about Robert's book, at that time going to be titled While God Lay Sleeping, that possibly I could help with that. And Mabel contacted me, and some of y'all might know I had a book earlier called We Will Shoot Back. I was working on that book, and I needed to finish that one, so I said I couldn't work on it at that time. When we got through it, We Will Shoot Back, I heard Mabel had cancer. And I wasn't going to contact her. That wasn't the prevailing thing to be contacting her about a book. Mabel passed in 2014, and then a couple of years later, and I don't think John remembered meeting me at that time. I heard from John. He invited me to come to a meeting in Detroit. I met with Meet Lisa at that time, and Claude was there. Muhammad Ahmed was there. I don't know if y'all heard of a great historian, John Bracey, who was also, a lot of people don't just think of him as an academic, but he was also involved in a revolutionary action movement, for those of you who heard of that particular organization. And he knew the Williams. And so they invited both us there, and John Williams kind of gave us a task. And this is 2016, at that point, we had experienced Trayvon Martin already. We'd experienced Mike Brown being killed and the Ferguson uprising that spawned from the killing of Mike Brown, the murder of Mike Brown, and other movements, other forms of other resistance that was coming, particularly from our youth at that time. And John wanted the story of his parents to be added to their toolkit because he said there were several things that our youth needed to know that armed resistance was an important aspect of our overall fight back against our oppressors. And he laid out other things at that particular time. And so he wanted the publication of this book to come out at that particular, to come out, and I think because of his health, he was paralyzed at that point from the neck down. He couldn't work on it any longer. And in the manuscript we got, in fact, you could see where Mabel and John had made some contribution to editing it to that point. And so he kind of left it in our hands, and then, you know, John would pass maybe 6 months after that meeting, and it was basically Lisa, who commanded the ship, put it in our hands, gave us our marching orders, got on our case at different points. And a funny part of the story, we finished editing Robert's piece. And I'm kind of the type, once I get something edited or ready to go, I want it to be published. But John Bracey, and this is, I think, one of his greatest contributions to the project, he looked at it and he said, and he knew both of them, he said, where's Mabel's voice? Where's Mabel's voice in this? We need Mabel's voice. I said, brother, can we just get this thing out? No, I insist, where's Mabel's voice? And John, it was my elder. I had to shut up and listen. And so we brought it back to to Lisa. And then Lisa's response was, so you two brothers are gonna edit Mabel's part? No, we need a woman on this team. And we deliberated, we found an excellent person. Unfortunately, she's not here with us today, but she is the excellent person to partner on this. If you know Gloria House, also known as Aneb Kokosile in the New African community in Detroit, Gloria was involved in Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. If you ever heard of the campaign in Lowndes County, that's where, you know, Kwame Ture and others helped organize in that community. Third party, and Lowndes County was a community of that was like 85% black, but they had no black elected officials because the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party would allow black people to participate in the primaries. So they created their own party, and it's the first political organization in the United States to use a Black Panther as a symbol. That's where the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense and other Black Panthers parties got their inspiration from. So she's a part of that effort, and she was also involved in the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. And internationalist, been to Cuba. She's also a poet. And so she was a perfect person, and it actually was Lisa's suggestion. She said, what about Sister Deb? And once she got on the project, not to mention the fact, I always tell people I'm an Ebonic speaker. She has more adeptness in standard American English than I do. So speaks French as well. Fortunately, we didn't have any French in the book. But so that's how my relationship and that's how the team came together. But I always think of Mabel and John in terms of the editorial part being a key part of the process. John, for me, in terms of giving us our marching orders that day in 2016. And so I kind of feel like this piece, for me, is kind of spiritually driven, driven by ancestors who had their hand on the process. Ashe.
And just to add briefly, Mabel had only written just slightly over 20 pages of her memoir, which she had been working on when health issues just overwhelmed her ability to do that. So fortunately, we were able to draw on a lot of other material, both the oral history that I did with Lincoln Bergman with her in 2003 and 2004, as well as interviews that she did in the Bay Area the first time we brought her here to speak, and I can't quite remember the year, but we did an event where she and Kathleen Cleaver were talking about the history of armed self-defense and the Black movement cross-generationally, because they were in different generations. And then a second trip where Mabel and John came and did an event with Amiri and Amina Baraka. So we were very blessed to have a very rich connection, and that became a way of flushing out Mabel's voice in the book itself. And, you know, if you grab a copy at some point, I mean, it's pretty amazing stuff all the way around. So maybe we can hear just a little bit more audio, and then we'll jump back into our conversation here.
We always had shortwave radio. Listening to the radio, Robert kept thinking, well, there's nothing coming out of the U.S. officially that is telling our story, telling about what's going on with the Black people in the United States. And we need to get that message out. And so he approached Fidel Castro with the idea of establishing a radio program that would be his program that would tell what's going on in the United States. He agreed with Rob, okay, you can have the program, and Rob decided to call it Radio Free Dixie, because Rob had decided that we wanted to have a musical program, but at the same time, the music to attract the attention of the people, jazz, protest music that came out of our struggle, so we could get people's attention, and then we would be able to give them the message of what was happening to our people in the United States in the struggle. Mainly, Rob wrote his own script. The editorials were his. One of my main jobs was reading news items that we were able to get from the struggle going on in the United States and making announcements as well, and helping to select the music. And we had a weekly program that was rebroadcast.
So at this point, of course, they're in exile. And one of the things that is so sharp in understanding their politics was their level of internationalism and a long history with Cuba. So maybe we could talk about that for a moment. Do you want to jump in first, Akinyele, with us?
Well, that was one thing I got from working on this project, because I knew about the Williams being in Cuba and, of course, the work they did there, as well as going to China. I didn't know until working on it that Robert Williams was in solidarity with Cuba for almost the inception of the Cuban Revolution. So he's one of the first people from the United States to go to Cuba. He was on a delegation with people like, if you heard of the historian John Henry Clark, or the novelist John Oliver Killens, Leroy Jones, later Amiri Baraka. So they all going to Cuba almost from the inception. You know, oftentimes we make note of Malcolm X providing solidarity to Cuba when they come to Harlem in 1960, but it's around the same time of Robert Williams. And not only does he travel to Cuba, but then he goes around the country He's part of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee inside the United States and trying to build solidarity with the Cuban Revolution again before he goes into exile, even planting a Cuban flag on his yard, front yard in Monroe, North Carolina. So and that has to be pretty bold, showing your solidarity in that way in the 1950s. So he's early 1960s, I should say. So he's showing his solidarity. I did not realize as well until you get into the manuscript of the book that I always thought, well, how did they get to Cuba? Did they, you know, sneak into Mexico and, you know, catch us? How did they get down? I didn't know that Fidel Castro and them actually went and got him. They, you know, Fidel knew who Robert Williams was, right? Because the Crusader, their newsletter, was already making it down there, okay? And people knew about it, as well as not only did he go on that first trip, they invited him back. So they knew who Robert Williams was, and apparently from what Rob says, that they got word that Fidel Castro said when he was being sought that if he made it to any embassy, they were supposed to provide him refuge. So it showed, like, on both ends, on Rob's end and on the part of the Cuban Revolution, the sense of having solidarity. So Rob is an internationalist way before he goes to Cuba. I mean, even before the experience in Monroe, which is probably one of the reasons they so scared of him when he was in the U.S. military as well. You know, so that was a developing politics he had during that time.
I would just like to add that the program they did, Radio Free Dixie, it said that it was able to get to the soldiers in Vietnam, and they heard that broadcast, and they loved the music and the political talk. And one lady in Cuba, in the book, said that, you know, I like your program that you do here on Radio Free Dixie. She said, but what is this fascination you have with cats? All you talk about is these white cats and these black cats are just really great. And she said, well, you know, that's just a slang that we African Americans use when we're talking about people that we really like and what they're doing, you know. And she fell out laughing, the lady did. But I remember one time John and I, we were at the jazz festival in Detroit that we have every Labor Day weekend, and Abby Lincoln was there. And so when she did her finished her set, John went and spoke to her, and he just thanked her for her repertoire of music and that his father and mother really enjoyed her pieces, and that's why they included them often when they broadcast Radio Free Dixie.
You know, Abby Lincoln and Max Roach did fundraisers for Monroe. Okay. Yeah, I have a flyer I found, just again working on this and trying to, Charles Mingus, they would perform fundraisers, you know, do a performance fundraiser and send the money to Monroe. So, you know, that's part of that appreciation as well, I suppose.
Maybe we should add a little something about the relationship to Malcolm.
Well, that was another thing. But, you know, and this really comes clear through the interview that Lincoln and Clyde does. That's a part of the book. And, you know, again, we should give hand to Freedom Archives, Nathaniel. Because I have to correct Claude on something. It was 21 pages.
Okay.
It was 21. I'm playing. Okay. It was actually 21. So we had to, and again, Bracey was insistent. So we, you know, we got it together. We figured out a way creatively to get it done. But, yeah, so now Malcolm, while he's in the Nation of Islam, he invited Robert to speak at Temple No. 7 in Nation of Islam. Now, If you don't know anything about the Nation of Islam, it's rare for somebody who wasn't in the Nation of Islam to be invited to be a speaker. And not only did that Robert speak there, they raised money to buy guns to send to Monroe during that particular time. So that was one of the things, and probably one of the things that probably got Malcolm in trouble in the Nation of Islam, because, you know, Elijah Muhammad didn't want him to have such a political posture in the Nation of Islam during that time. But they raised money, and Malcolm would encourage the folks to read their newsletter, The Crusader. And so I consider Malcolm a part of that network, along with other people in the left, in black nationalist circles across the United States, on the more militant side of the civil rights movement, that was that alternative civil rights movement to the nonviolent movement at that particular time. So yeah, they definitely had that relationship that corresponded even after Robert would go back home. And Mabel talks about how they stayed in touch with each other.
Let's listen to a little bit more audio, and then we'll swing back through.
We had gone to Vietnam prior to our final move to China. There was a peace conference that took place in Hanoi. And Rob and I went to Hanoi and participated in the conference in support of the Vietnamese people in their fight against the United States. We met Ho Chi Minh. We met one young man who had been napalmed by our American troops. We met with a pilot who had been shot down over Vietnam. They brought him to have an evening with us. The Vietnamese brought him.
We were guests of Ho Chi Minh.
So, in terms of their internationalism and the relationships that were being built in that period between the Black Liberation Movement in the U.S. and the global struggles, that, to me, that was, you know, one of the very striking things in digging into the story and in eliciting from Mabel, you know, a narrative of how they were moving in the world. Radio Free Dixie, clearly an aspect of that. And for me at the time, I would just say parenthetically that in doing radio, which both Lincoln and I were doing together and doing creative news, it too kind of draws from that sense of wanting to not to separate politics and culture, to really see it as part of an essential relationship. And Radio Free Dixie clearly does that. And to the extent that we were able to unearth actual physical recordings of that, it allows us to, you know, understand that in a real way, but also it's because of the preservation of some of that material that we're able to listen to so much of Robert's voice in the course of, you know, this program that we did, which you can either to pump it. We've got it here in CD form, or you can go to our Bandcamp channel and actually listen to all of this audio that we're sampling here. And it's a pretty, it's an extremely moving thing to hear their stories in their own voice. So I would encourage you to do that, or you can get it as a download or whatever. But internationalism clearly is a significant, if not a central part of how they understood the world and how they functioned in it. And that's true when they return as well. So in a way, Lisa, maybe you could speak to how your understanding of that part of who they were, how did that work in the family?
Well, one of the things I'm so admirable of them and their stance is that in that period of time, they stayed. Rob had international connections, as you say. He could have left. But he stayed and stood his ground and fought the good fight, even putting himself and his family at risk because he was committed to trying to make Monroe a better place, a livable place, even though he had economic boycott against him and he couldn't work. When he would get a job, somebody would come and say, you know, one of the lawmen would come and say, well, you got this guy working for you in your plant. You don't want him in here. And so the first day would be his last day. And that happened over and over again. Mom talked about that once when we went to a conference, the Black Family Development Conference. And the theme of the conference that year was La Cupenda. Is that how you say it? Black love?
Na Cupenda.
Yeah. So she was a keynote speaker on that issue. I think Mr. McMillan was the one that was running the conference at the time. And they chose her because she... not only loved her husband, but she was committed to the same fight and the same struggle that he was. She was often asked about that, and sometimes there were people who would try to interject a feminist perspective about it and maybe even cause division. And she said, well, his struggle is my struggle. I'm fighting for my freedom just like he is. It's no difference. But the fascination a lot of people had, even our cousin, Jonathan Blunt, who was one of the five founders of Essence Magazine, used to say, and he said this at Rob's funeral too, he said, this woman chased him halfway around the world. And you know this was some love. She went through all of that, the starvation here in Monroe, and had to fight off the Klan and the crackers and... And still, she stayed with him until the end. And it's a beautiful love story. A woman from the Netherlands, Christine Odom, came and interviewed her, and she wrote a novel called They Had Their Love and Their Guns. It hasn't been translated in English yet, but she says it any day now. So, but anyway... I guess when you have to go into exile into a couple of different countries, you're forced into a connection that seldom exists because you all are dependent on each other. And that's why John and Bobby, his brother, were so close. You know, even though they both were talking Chinese to each other and Spanish and all that, but they were pretty much all they had, you know, in a foreign land, until they made friends, you know, until they got connected. But they were dependent upon each other. And so was Rob. I noticed the two of them, especially Rob, he was very clingy to Mom, always wanting her to be by his side. So, you know, they had many friends. I think that the weekend that we got married, Eureka, what's her last name? How do you say her name? The Japanese lady.
Oh, Yuriko
Kashima. Yuriko Kashima. She came and visited and stayed the week with us right after we got back from our honeymoon. And that was an interesting relationship. She brought us a beautiful present from Japan, but she also educated me on the culture of her race and how some of the people that we met were the same race, only a different people, you know. But I think one of the things that it makes me think about is that the struggle makes strange bedfellows, and you don't know who you're going to need to survive as an ally. So, you know, it's not always the people that look like you. I'm mindful of John going over to Toronto to stay with a white couple, and he and Bobby. And there's quite a few interesting stories about that. But when we got married, he wanted to go back to thank the man who he called Uncle Kelly. And so we talked to his daughters, and they told us where they lived, and we went, and they told us that he was in a nursing home. So John wanted to buy him a really nice robe and take it to him. When we got there, he was in dementia, and he barely knew that we were even there. And so John went up to him and whispered into his ear. And just for a moment, Uncle Kelly raised his head and smiled at John. He just wanted to thank him for keeping them safe. We got back to the house. I don't know if any of you have ever seen the movie Antoine Fisher and that big family gathering with the food and all. Well, that's what we ran into when we got back. All the uncles and nieces and grands and everything were there. And they were asking questions, and they wanted to know. We always wanted to know who those two little black boys' picture on the wall was. Because the only child that they had at the time, she was a babe in arms. The rest of them hadn't even come into existence yet. So to have an international connection kept them alive.
I could add just one of the reasons international solidarity is in the title. And actually, I think John Bracy, and particularly Aneb Gloria House, emphasized that not only in terms of it being a story, as Lisa just said, about the importance of international networks protecting them when they were being sought, not only before they get to Cuba, because it's folks who are part of the Crusader Network in Canada, some black folks, West Indian folks who were living there, providing them shelter, right? So that's an important part of the story, internationalism on that part, and being protected in Cuba and China. But also the role that Robert and Mabel and the sons play in terms of representing our liberation movement internationally. So much a part of this story, I think of it actually, the armed resistance, the international solidarity, but also the role they're playing as journalists too. That's the title would have been too long. We'd have thrown that in there, but you know, before they leave the United States doing, and I hope I'm not jumping ahead in terms of questions, but the role they're playing producing the Crusader, and we have to mention another ancestor, because it's Robert, it's Mabel, but a sister by the name of Ethel Azalea Johnson, who created the Crusader initially. Then them continue to produce that and smuggle it into the United States from Cuba and China. Maybe you could tell us how they got there from China. But anyway, I hope that, sorry to put you on Front Street. And then, and they're doing Radio Free Dixie from Cuba. And see, the part of Robert, he always wanted to be a writer long before, again, his movement activism elevates. So, and what I didn't know, we could have included earlier, Clyde told me after we finished the introduction, that Mabel's doing some of the artwork. And so their role in journalism, I think, should also be noted as well.
So we could go on, but we could also see if there's some issues or questions that you'd like to address. So we've got a way to do that, in fact.
I would like to read a brief.
Do you want to read something? Yeah, go ahead and do that, and then we'll lead into trying to involve everybody in the conversation. You'll need your mic. Do you want me to hold the mic?
Okay.
me to hold the microphone for you so you can read, or do you want it? Okay, I think you've got yours there if you want.
Okay. This is a story about an attempt on Rob's life. The folks, the police tried to stop him. And prior to this, he was at an encounter with them, and a police officer, one of the bigots, the police officer witnessed him bust out his headlights and the taillight and something else and side view mirror. And so they stopped him on account of he had a busted headlight. And so this is in the daytime as well. Okay. After one of our Saturday deliveries, he was delivering the Crusader. I was stopped by the police 3 blocks from my house. It so happened that I was stopped with great fanfare in front of Reverend J.J. Lomax's home. The policeman informed me that I was operating a motor vehicle without my lights being on. He said my lights were defective. He was fully aware that the mob had watched as my car had been wrecked at the hilltop on the way to the pool demonstration. Reverend Lomax was sitting in his yard under a shade tree. I loudly called out, asking him if it was night or day. He answered, "Of course, Robert, it is day. What do you ask such an obvious question?" I told him that this policeman was saying that it was night. He laughed and replied, "Oh no, it's definitely daylight, Robert." The demeanor of the two policemen was hostile indignation. After some verbal exchange, I was given an option of being hauled off into the patrol car to the police station or following them in my car that they had already declared unfit to be on the road because of the broken lights. I opted for driving behind them to the station. After being given an order to follow close behind, I acceded to their flawed legality based on their propensity to harass me and to interfere with the delivery of the Crusader, and followed the patrol car for almost 2 blocks. We crossed the intersection at Farley Avenue and English Streets. The next intersection was Farley Avenue and Boyd Street. I lived on Boyd Street, halfway up the block. This was precisely why I had offered to follow the two policemen to the station in my own car. As they crossed over Boyd Street, I was approached. I shifted gears, accelerated, and made a sharp left turn toward my house. Blasting the car horn, I sped around my house and stopped near the back door. The back door was locked as usual. The police car had turned around and breakneck speed had followed me into my backyard. I owned a very ferocious German Shepherd named Little Rock. The dog was on the leash. The sight of the officers invading the yard had provoked a temper tantrum on the part of the dog. I tried to release him to ward off the police, but he was exerting so much pressure pulling on that chain toggle, I was unable to free him. My wife, Mabel, opened the back door. She was armed with a 12-gauge shotgun. I called to my 10-year-old son, Bobby, to bring my rifle. My wife asked the policeman what they wanted with me. They informed her that they were going to be taking me in for operating a motor vehicle with defective lights. She asked them if they had a warrant for my arrest. And when they answered in the negative, she told them that they had better get out of her yard until such time that they did have one. The commotion drew a crowd of armed black friends from the neighborhood. As the crowd swelled and surrounded policemen, their nervousness and fear became very much obvious. Armed with my 8mm semi-automatic Mauser rifle and surrounded by armed friends, I ordered the hate-motivated illegal cops out of my yard. I told them that I wanted to hear their wheels spinning until they got out the block, or else I was going to blow their asses up. And if they wanted me, they had better bring a warrant. You know, I think, you know, considering the perilous times that we're in, it's so important to have friends that will come to your defense. Those neighbors didn't have to do that, and not all of them were the guard. They were some of just people that had a pistol in the house and saw the commotion. And they came and surrounded Rob and Mom. But also think about Mom. She wasn't just a Tammy Wynette stand by her man. She was fighting for their very lives. And she didn't back down. I don't know if I have that in me, but time will tell.
So there's a lot of richness in the book, which I hope you get and read. Let's open this up as a conversation. Anybody want to? It's hard to see with these lights.
There's a hand by David.
Well, thank you so much. This is a fabulous.
There we go.
I see the light.
Okay. It's on.
Yeah, the green light.
Try it now.
Well, hopefully you can hear me.
Yeah, we can.
Okay. I had two questions, a political one and then one about the book. I'm interested in how they got to China and that whole, you know, like we're more familiar with Cuba, but how was it that they got to China and what was that like? And also, if you could explain the difference between the older edition of the book and the new edition, just so we know, you know, for people who have the old one, should we also get the new one?
I think you mean by the older Negroes with guns.
No, I was thinking of the first edition of this book.
Oh, no, that's a resource guide that Freedom Archives put together that gives, for any educator, I think, needs that book in particular. But I think you might be talking about Negroes with Guns, the difference between, which was Robert's first book. The difference is that.
Yeah, I feel like I can see it, but I don't remember the title.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, Negroes with Guns, it probably is. And that covers, like, up to them getting to Cuba. And so this, like, gives more background, because Robert started working on this right when he comes back from, right when he comes back from China to the United States. And so it covers not only that again, but the part of them being in Cuba and getting to what I think you might be asking is some of the issues they had in Cuba, as well as being in China, traveling through Africa, and then coming back to the United States, and then some of the period of time in the United States. Robert and Mabel first go to China. It's after the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. And Robert Williams, even though he was in exile in Cuba and, you know, with some people feel relatively safe, and I think about this now as particularly in the context of Asada, because a few times I got to see Asada in Cuba. She's, even though she was welcome and loved by the, you know, Cuban people and protected by the Cuban Revolution, she's always thinking about the struggle here. She's always wanting to know what's happening, what she could do. I've even heard some recordings from some of the people just a little bit younger than me who did some work in advancing work around our political prisoners. They said Sada and Honda would always say, you got to go back and get our comrades. That's, you know, was most important to them. So Robert, after the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church, appealed to world leaders, international leaders, about the bombing, wanting them to make a statement. And it was Mao Zedong who made the statement, who listened to that appeal And after that, Mao invited the Williams family to China. So in 1963, they go to China for the first time. Robert mentions in a book that there's elements of the U.S. left who have some influence in Cuba. And he feels that some of them, and you know, it's implied the CIA as well, are trying to sabotage what's happening with the family in Cuba, particularly in them doing the radio program, sending the crusader out. And his particular politics amongst some in the U.S. left weren't seen as appropriate politics. Same people had problems with Malcolm X. And so he thought maybe his work was limited there at that time and there was only so much he could do. And it's actually the Vietnamese, because it wasn't an easy thing politically to negotiate for him, for the family to get from Cuba to China. He'd been to China before, by this time they had done the rally in Vietnam. He had a relationship with the Vietnamese people and the Vietnamese revolution, but they basically engineered for them to get from Cuba to China. Yeah, from Cuba to China at that time. And I want to say this, he never abandoned his solidarity with the Cuban Revolution, but it was elements there. He describes, Robert said he was a black nationalist, in particular a revolutionary black nationalist at this point, but he had support for what he called revolutionary communists, but he was opposed to what he called bourgeois communists that he saw in Cuba and in the United States at that particular time. He always respects Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and makes it quite clear that some of their support allowed supportive Cuban workers to help them produce the radio program and a newsletter. So, I just want to be clear, even though it might be complicated to some, but, you know, that was his analysis at that time.
I'd just like to say, regarding going to China from Cuba, John and Bobby really had the jaws with Rob about going to China. They were really dug in Cuba, and they had their little crew and friends, and Bobby had a girlfriend, and and they were not interested in going to China. And they got on a barge, and Bobby had a rough time. He was throwing up every 15 minutes. But they made it anyway, and they went first.
Yeah, they went first.
And they got there, and you know, they liked Cuba, they liked the music, they liked the people, they liked the food, they liked the atmosphere. One of the things John said that we put in a program that was not his memorial, but his a celebration that everybody wanted to do for him while he was still living. He was ill at the time, but they wanted to do a celebration of him. And what he said was that when he got to Cuba, he saw a pool, a swimming pool, and there were kids of every color in the rainbow. And they were running around, having fun, and screaming, and swimming, and playing. And he said, wow. And this is what we have been fighting for in Monroe, North Carolina. So they really loved Cuba, but they had to get on a barge and go to China. And the tragedy was that no sooner than he had learned algebra in Spanish, he had to turn around and learn it again in Chinese so he could graduate.
Anyone else?
I just want to follow up on one thing. I didn't think about this till you mentioned it, Lisa, but him seeing that in Cuba in a swimming pool, what got the Klan so riled up that they had to form a self-defense group was about them protesting around having access to the swimming pool. They didn't even want to swim in at the same time as white kids.
They just wanted to be able to swim in the swimming pool that they're paying taxes on. So, you know, it's just amazing. And just to, you know, that was the other thing. We wanted to have a book from the students, from the son's perspective as well, you know. But.
Another incident at the swimming pool and the protests when, I think this is covered in Radio Free Dixie, so, but where they were protesting the swimming pool and some of the biggest start shooting at them. And so Rob had his rifle with him and he said to the police officer, the guard that was there, he said, "Did you hear that? Did you hear that right gunshot fire coming over this way?" He said, "What gunshot fire? I didn't hear nothing." He said, "Oh, you didn't hear any gunshots?" He said, "No, I don't hear any gunshots." He said, "Well, good, because maybe you won't hear those when I start shooting too."
That's funny. Brother's back.
Thank you very much. This has been an incredible conversation to listen to. The last couple of years, I think, since October 7th, the question of the role of armed resistance and of the morality of armed resistance has really been kind of front and center on the left. I think the international left. I'm curious if you can talk about how the work and the example of Robert and Mabel can inform some of these conversations and debates that we're having around the role of armed struggle in anti-colonial movements, but also just in anti-fascist movements, and what your what Robert and Mabel's work can teach us about armed resistance in our context now.
That's a good question. I think that when you talk about looking at Moreau, you're talking about a community under siege. And these same issues actually came up even after they're in Cuba and China, really more Cuba, in the civil rights movement. As I remember, outside of research on the book, seeing this meeting in Atlanta, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1964. And some of the members of SNCC in 1964, they were start carrying guns in the Freedom House. And why? Because prior to that they had to escape some, not just night riders, but people who were coming in Freedom House to kill them. They had to go on a roof, and fortunately, the people didn't know they were on a roof and left. And it got to the point, not only did they know that there were plans to kill them at the Freedom House, but the CIA the intelligence unit for the civil rights movement was oftentimes black women who worked in white folks' homes. And they found lists of people who were going to be assassinated. And so they found it necessary, and it wasn't just the folks in SNCC, but people in that community to provide some protection and defense. So, because they didn't want to just give up their lives. And again, we're not talking about a demonstration. You're not talking about a march. You're talking about in people's homes where they sleep, where their children sleep, other family members sleep. So it just becomes a question of protection. Now, that's different from, say, like guerrilla warfare, which is a different piece. But I'm not making a comment on what happened on October 7th. I'm not intelligent enough to make that analysis right now. I'm just joking. Y'all didn't laugh. But I think, when you talk about in a collective sense, again, where people are, like what we're experiencing right now in Gaza, it's actually a genocide occurring, right? And genocides occur in different types of ways, you know. And so I think we still have to look to the people have a right to defend their lives on by any means that they have available to them, particularly when the international community seems to be, as Malcolm used to say, either unwilling or unable to protect a particular people. And so I'm still not one to condemn what people do when they're desperate and they're trying to survive and they're trying to establish their human rights and their integrity, you know, that people have that right. Of course, we don't want to commit acts that are, I remember, y'all, some of y'all old enough might remember this movie, Lion of the Desert, about Libyan freedom fighter fighting against the Italians. I forgot what year. Somebody out there old enough to remember like me. I see a couple of gray hairs. But I remember in the conclusion of the movie, the actor who's playing this Libyan freedom fighter is saying that the Italians weren't his teachers. So, you know, I'm still kind of the kind of position. There's a certain type of revolutionary morality we need to have. And just like similar to the philosophy of nonviolence, that it can have an impact as well. There's a power in revolutionary morality as well. So that's generally how I see it. I don't condemn that. I certainly wouldn't condemn anyone, any oppressed people who are trying to fight for their own integrity, their survival, their lives, and the lives of their people.
I would like to say, in the words of Mom, Rob really believed in the law, and he tried every way he could to exhaust it. And at every turn, he got the door slammed in his face until that last case where the woman, man had tried to rape this woman who was 8 months pregnant and dragged her down some stairs. And he didn't rape her, but people intervened and stopped it. So they took it to court because the people wanted to kill that man. And Rob intervened and said, no, let's let the law handle it. Let's let the law handle it. And they went to court. And there was a black guy and a white woman that was an attorney for them. And the white woman, she barely got to even announce her name before the case was dismissed. But before they got to that part, the judge, the attorney for the guy that was trying to rape her, he pointed to the gentleman that was going to rape the woman and his wife. He was sitting with his wife, and he said, you know, he said, look at this man. He's sitting with his wife, this beautiful white woman, the pure flower of life. And do you think that he would go through all that for that, pointing to the black woman? And they dismissed the case. And so then after that, the crowd of women crying came up to Rob and said, okay, now what are you going to say?
Right.
And that's when he made that statement about fighting violence with violence. You know, at a certain point, people say up here and no further. You know, you get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And then you have no other choice. When the law says that the law is for not for you, it's for the white man. You have no recourse here. What else can you do? And I look around at the present times that we're in, and I often feel like I see people in one of the seven stages of grief, denial, where we're really not ready to face the animal that's in front of us, and the wolf is crouching at the door, ready to suck the very marrow out of your bones. But will we respond? And so he made the sacrifice. Now, why he did it, why he and Mom did it, I can't even say, because all thing I can think of is that some answer the call and some don't. And he had the what they call the right stuff to answer the call, to make the sacrifice, because he surely was counting the cost. He went into it with his eyes wide open, but he did it anyway. And because of that, the people armed themselves and defended their community. And it was effective, so much so that after that clash in 1957 with the Klan, the council called an emergency meeting and banned the Knight Riders from Monroe unless they had a special permit from the sheriff. So they never came back into that community again. And so the moral to me is that if you resist, you can affect change.
If I could add, If I could add something to it briefly, and this probably doesn't answer the question, but if you go back and hear the first quote we have from Mabel, and she talks about really the enemy being just segregation. There's another point where she will say, particularly after they had to leave Monroe, when the whole family's lives were threatened. She said, but then they see that the FBI is behind this. So it's bigger than just these local racists in Monroe. And they're being sought all over the United States. But one of the things you see from Robert and Mabel, as Lisa said, at a certain point he believes in the law. And then I definitely see when the Crusaders that they're calling for armed struggle, you know, particularly after the church is bombed in Birmingham, because from my reading, Rob and Mabel are believing genocide is going to happen to black folks in the United States. So they align themselves. Have you ever heard of the group, the Revolutionary Action Movement, that call for revolution in the United States? They're mentors to that organization. They're in correspondence with people in the United States. Because again, I think they're saying it has to be a revolution in society. When Rob is speaking in Vietnam, this is not in the book. They talk about him speaking in Vietnam, but if you go back and look at the Crusader that's in the Freedom Archives, he's speaking on behalf of the Revolutionary Action Movement at that point. And then the following year or two, then he accepts being the president of the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. So I think you see in their story, and I see it more in Mabel's than I see it in Rob's, you see kind of a growth in terms of their political stance at different points. Now, in terms of course, we don't have them unless we could do a seance. I can't interpret what they would say about Hamas and October 7th, so I really can't speak on that. But it's certainly, they assess their situations and they make positions based upon what they see their reality is at a particular moment.
One of the things my husband would often say is that self-defense and having arms is a deterrent. You got to bring some to get some.
So maybe what we could do is close out with the last little audio piece, unless there's something really pressing. We've been sitting for a long time, and we can we want to dedicate some time for informal conversation. If you've bought a book, to get it inscribed by Akinyele and Lisa. So maybe if we can close out with that last little audio piece, Let's do that, and then there'll be a little more time to hang.
Having built networks of people who have really the true interests of the people at heart all over the world. And I think that there still is that element of people who are out there working, and that we all constitute a real power, but we don't know it.
Thank you all very much for coming today. Thank you, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. What's your name again?